Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, December 12th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, two Humboldt County men convicted of double murder in Butte County. Eureka Fishing Industry needs detailed and report. And Ray Hamill with the sports report. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Content warning. The story contains descriptions of a murder and the use of fire to hide the evidence. This may be upsetting to some listeners. People who have experienced similar events to the content discussed may find some of the story difficult to hear. In Butte County, a jury convicted two Humboldt County men, 43-year-old Samuel Ashley and 45-year-old Wesley Evans, of two counts of first-degree murder of 26-year-old Juan Daniel Areola Solano and 22-year-old Ezequiel Vele Arellano Jr. KMUD talked with Mark Murphy, the chief deputy DA in Butte County, who went over the entire timeline of the case.
The late morning hours of January 30th, there was a 911 call from a PG&E worker that a burned vehicle had been found under some power lines in the Cherokee area of Butte County. This road was called Condor Road, and it is a dirt road that this portion of the road goes under a series of high power lines that are managed by PG&E. The CAL FIRE responded. And when they got out there, they found a car that had been largely self-extinguished, meaning that everything in the vehicle had burned. And as the CAL FIRE captain walked around the car, he realized there were two very badly burned bodies in the car, in both the driver's seat and the front passenger seat. And that led to the investigation that followed. The investigation discovered that the two victims, Ezequiel and Danny, had traveled from the Humboldt area to Butte County with the two defendants, Mr. Ashley and Mr. Evans. Information from various witnesses led the investigators to believe that this was for a gun deal. In the 5 days before January 30th, there had been a great deal of communication between the two defendants and between both of the defendants and one of the victims. We learned that the victim had fronted some money for this illicit gun deal and was upset the deal was not coming to fruition. The autopsy revealed that both of the victims had been shot once in the head and were dead before the fire had started. Fire was started around 6:18 a.m. and burned for quite a while before it was reported by PG&E. It's a very rural, isolated area without much activity. After the murder, the defendants dropped a enclosed trailer in an area called Concow, which is not too far from Cherokee. And the trailer was supposed to be used to bring firearms back to the Humboldt area. However, we found a witness who had said that he was in discussions with Samuel Ashley to purchase the trailer before the January 30th murder. And that tells us that there was never a real plan for any gun deal, that this trailer was like a giant prop, if you will, to mislead the victims into thinking that there was a gun deal. After the murders, both of the defendants stopped using their cell phones. Their cell phones were never found despite multiple search warrants. And they drove to a Walmart in Chico where they bought clothing. They then drove to a Dollar General in Red Bluff, where they purchased various items, including body wash. And then for 2 hours, we don't know where they were. The next stop was a Napa Auto Parts store in Red Bluff, where they bought a nail brush, some light bulbs for the truck, and heavy-duty hand soap. Their next stop was a Hay Fork, and in Hay Fork, law enforcement was able to locate a witness who said that one of the defendants asked him to chop up a revolver, which was then tossed out onto a roadway. And the defendants had a bag of clothing. Some of the items in the bag included blue jeans and tennis shoes. The witness said the tennis shoes had what appeared to be blood on them. and that bag of clothing was burned outside of Cape Fork. February 10th, there were multiple search warrants executed in the Humboldt area, and both of the defendants were arrested. Their cell phones were never found, and the clothing that they were wearing on January 30th, much of it was never found. The defendants were then interviewed on February 10th. Both of the defendants stated that they had not left the Humboldt area in late January of 2025, and we know from security video that that was clearly not true.
The trial started November 3rd and concluded on December 7th. During the trial, 23 witnesses took the stand, along with over 200 exhibits of evidence. The jury took 5 hours to deliberate before finding the defendants guilty as charged. Ashley and Evans now face life without the possibility of parole. The sentencing is scheduled for January 9th. A new report details fishing industry needs in the Eureka waterfront, Daniel Mintz reports.
Eureka is paying attention to the needs of the local fishing industry, and a new report on it is headed to the City Council for review. Produced through interviews with fishermen and those involved in the industry, the report was discussed at the December 10th Eureka Planning Commission meeting. Commissioner Michael Kraft worked with city staff and the city's Economic Development Commission to produce recommendations focusing on challenges and opportunities regarding fishing infrastructure and economic conditions. Kraft summarized some of the highlights.
There's some real practical cost issues, ice, fuel, accessibility of cold storage, and how one can find that. And a number of these are longstanding. A number of these are maddening. There should be better access to the ice equipment than there is, and why fuel that comes through Humboldt Bay is more expensive here than it is in other places. Same gasoline going off there, but our fishing fleet, along with, you know, those of us in the room who put gas in cars, pay more locally. On the other end, buying fish buyers, more would be better. That's largely a private industry thing. But there have been small happenings that have helped, and the kind of ongoing but also some growing direct-to-consumer, so the dockside market, shows a little bit of promise.
Some of the industry's most pressing concerns are outside of the city's scope, including the state's fishing regulations. Kraft said, quote, if fishermen could be granted one wish, it would be along the lines of, I wish we could just be more like Oregon. Recent economic developments are also challenging, including the closure of the Pacific Choice Seafoods processing plant. Kraft said Pacific Choice is still receiving catches for transfer to Oregon facilities and still sells ice to the fishing fleet, but on a somewhat limited basis. During a public comment period, longtime local and regional fishing industry advocate Ken Bates said the city's engagement is encouraging, but the situation with the Pacific Choice plant is concerning due to the practices of its parent company.
I'm really, really happy that the Planning Commission and the staff are willing to start this conversation. I'm probably either way too much of an optimist or need to have counseling, but I have been trying to get this conversation going for years and years and years in this particular city government. So I think it's a very positive thing to see if the city is willing or interested in keeping the fishing fleet here, you know, or at least keeping a part of it here. There's lots of things that we see that are problematic. You know, you mentioned Pacific Seafood Group. These bigger companies, their business model is such that a lot of their fish that they were taking, they were sending them overseas for processing, you know, and they've shortened up their processing in various places. Pacific Seafood Group is known for shutting plants down and sort of hibernating, you know, and moving to other areas. And so it's sort of like keeping their foot on the thing so that nobody else is going to move in there and work.
Bates's specialty is the intersect between fishing and land use planning. He asked for, quote, zoning language that protects the working waterfront, and said fishermen view uses like restaurants as, quote, gentrification. Commissioner Steve Lazar noted a historical context and said restaurants can mesh with the fishing industry.
I think it's important to recognize historical uses. So even though Jack's Seafood is a new use per se, it sits in the footprint of Lazio Seafood. And I think Lazio's is an example of, I wasn't here for it, but it was a beloved establishment, and it certainly had a very direct nexus with the commercial fishing fleet. And so I think that's, if I'm going to be comfortable with that type of invasion of the space along the waterfront, that would be the model we'd want to try to promote and encourage and require, you know, not so much the sort of token restaurant that sits that abuts the shoreline or something like that.
The written version of the report estimates that there are 50 to 70 local fishing boats working out of Humboldt Bay. It notes that a waterfront fishing industrial district from sea to commercial streets and parts of Woodley Island is being proposed by staff and would allow fishing by right, while other uses might be allowed through discretionary permitting. The commission unanimously voted to forward the report to the City Council for consideration. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Ray Hamill brings us details of all the big local sports stories of the week, including how the Ferndale Wildcats fared in last weekend's state playoff game, all the latest high school and college basketball news, and why it was a big week for two local wrestlers.
It was a season for the ages for the Ferndale High football team, but as they say, all good things must come to an end, and the Wildcats finally met their match in last weekend's state playoffs. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the Wildcats and their historic season in just a moment, as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including all the latest boys and girls high school basketball news in what was a very busy week for the local contingent of teams, as well as some college basketball and why it was a big week for two local wrestlers. But first up, an historic and memorable season for the Ferndale football team ended last weekend in the Division 4 AA NorCal Regional Bowl game at the Redwood Bowl. The Wildcats, who came into the game unbeaten, faced off against Sutter High School and lost 21-7. The Wildcats started the stronger of the two teams and led 7-0 early in the night, but the Sutter Huskies would grow into the game and score 21 unanswered points, including 15 in a dominating second half. Interestingly, the Huskies are coached by McKinleyville High graduate and former Humboldt State football player Ryan Reynolds. While the loss ended the season for the Cats, it was nonetheless a season for the ages. Ferndale posted its first undefeated regular season since 2008 on the way to clinching the Little Four Championship, and the Wildcats would go on to win three straight playoff games in the North Coast Section Division 5 tournament, claiming a second section championship in 3 years and a 15th all-time. Switching gears, 17 HDNL varsity basketball teams were in action at various tournaments last weekend as the new season begins to build momentum. Here on the North Coast, the McKinleyville boys and Arcata girls both hosted tournaments. The Mac boys reached the championship game at the Panthers Tip-Off Classic with victories over Annerley and Ukiah in their opening two games. However, they would fall to Cardinal Newman in Saturday's championship game by a score of 55-49. The Panthers would bounce back with a non-tournament victory at Hoopa on Tuesday night, winning 78-38 to go to 5-1. There were several other local boys teams in action last weekend as well. Del Norte and Eureka faced off in an early season showdown in the championship game at the Wairika tournament, with the Warriors prevailing 59-55 in overtime to avenge a loss to Eureka in last year's Wairika tournament final. With the win, which was their fourth straight, the Del Norte boys improved to 4-1. The loss was the first of the season for the Eureka boys, who dropped to 4-1. St. Bernard's also reached the championship game at the Montgomery tournament with back-to-back wins over San Domenico and Montgomery, but they would lose a hard-fought final to Campo Lindo by just 2 points, falling 52-50. The Crusaders are now 2-1. The Arcata boys travelled for the always competitive Red Bluff tournament and dropped two of three games to go to 3-4 in the season, while Fortuna was in action at the McKinleyville tournament and lost two of three games, closing out with a 52-49 win over West Valley to go to 2-5. Hoopa and South Fork also travelled for tournaments. The Warriors went 1-2 at the Durham tournament before splitting a pair of non-tournament games against Weed and McKinleyville early this week. The South Fork boys travelled to Boonville for the annual Anderson Valley tournament and finished 2-2 in tournament play, including a 93-62 win over Potter Valley, which was the most points they have scored in a game in at least 20 years since Max Preps began keeping records. The Cubs also played Mendocino in non-tournament action on Tuesday night and lost 64-50 to drop to 2-6 on the season. Most of the HDNL boys teams are back in action at various tournaments this week. Arcata, Fortuna, Del Norte and Eureka will all feature in the 8-school Arcata tournament, which opened on Thursday afternoon and runs for 3 days, with the championship game set for 2:30 on Saturday. McKinleyville and St. Berners will be at the Mount Shasta tournament, and the South Fork boys will host their annual Gene Cotter Memorial Tournament. In local girls' high school basketball, meanwhile, the Eureka Loggers are enjoying an impressive start to the new season and won the Gridley Tournament Championship last weekend. The Loggers defeated Las Plumas in the championship game by a score of 59-28, and they are now 5-1 on the season. Closer to home, Arcata, South Fork and McKinleyville all competed in the first annual Tanya Campbell Classic at Arcata High School, with the tournament hosts reaching the championship game and falling 56-46 to Chico. The Arcata girls, who bounced back with a 58-44 non-tournament win at Trinity on Tuesday, are now 4-1. The South Fork girls dropped all three of their games at the Arcata tournament and are now 0-7, while McKinleyville went 2-1 in tournament action, including a 51-25 win over Emerald in the third place game, and is now 4-2 on the season. The St. Bernard's girls travelled to play at the Sonoma Valley tournament and went 2-1, including a 52-25 loss to the host school in the final. The Crusaders are now 2-2. The Ferndale girls also reached the championship game at the Cloverdale tournament, where they fell 61-56 in overtime to Division 2 Windsor, and the Cats are now 2-1. Fortuna travelled for the Calusa tournament and won 2 straight games after an opening loss, including a big 72-29 win over Forest Lake Christian in the consolation game. Most of the HDNL teams are back in action at various tournaments this week. Fortuna and McKinleyville are at the Healdsburg tournament, Eureka is at the Windsor tournament, St. Bernard's is at the Mount Shasta tournament, Del Norte is at the Harlan Carter tournament in Reading, and Ferndale is at the Weaverville Holiday Classic. In local college basketball, meanwhile, the College of the Redwoods men went 1-1 at their own Coach Tregg's Classic, bouncing back from a 93-79 loss to Southwestern Oregon on Friday with a 99-89 win over Mendocino on Saturday. CR is now 7-5. The CR women won a pair of games at the Shasta Crossover Tournament, defeating Solano 66-59 and beating Yuba 72-50 to go to 6-5. Both Cal Poly Humboldt teams opened conference play last weekend. The Humboldt men split 2 games, beating Stanislaus State and losing to UC Merced, while the women beat both Stanislaus and Merced. The CPH men are now 3-5, while the women are 3-3. And rounding out a busy week in local sports, 2 CR wrestlers have advanced to this weekend's state championships in Rockland after big performances at last weekend's NorCal Regional Tournament. Caleb Aguilera placed 6th at 133 pounds, while teammate Jared Williams was 7th at 165. The top 8 wrestlers in each bracket qualify for a state. And that's this week's K-Mud News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
California offshore wind gets a boost as moratorium struck down. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Groups that promote offshore wind power are hopeful that a big win in court will convince the federal government to consider permitting new projects. This week, a federal judge struck down President Donald Trump's Day One executive order, which halted all offshore wind approvals, and argued that the Biden administration unfairly favored renewable energy over oil and gas. Benjamin Collings is offshore wind advisor for the group Elected Officials to Protect America.
Each individual project is still going to have to continue the route it's on. For example, projects like in the Port of Humboldt, they can continue without being permanently stopped, which the White House was trying to do.
California has 5 offshore wind projects in development, 2 off of Humboldt Bay and 3 off the coast of Morro Bay. Companies are doing environmental studies as they prepare to apply for state permits. Collings says Trump's campaign against offshore wind is damaging on many levels.
For states like California to reach their goals on reducing carbon output, offshore wind projects are a big part of that equation. And in the long term, you're talking about jobs and billions of dollars of investment at stake.
Stephen Coleman is board president with the Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District, which is building a marine terminal at the port to receive offshore wind power in the future. Even though the project lost $435 million in federal funding, Coleman says it is important to move forward.
A really help rural communities who are in need of economic development. It will help remediate legacy industrial toxins along the bay. It will help redevelop industrial land.
It is unclear whether the administration will appeal the federal court ruling invalidating Trump's moratorium on offshore wind projects. More than 250 elected officials from across California have signed a letter from Elected Officials to Protect America in support of offshore wind energy. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Senate votes down GOP health bill. Affordable Care Act health costs to skyrocket. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
As part of the deal to reopen government, Republicans had promised a Senate vote on tax subsidies for the Affordable Care Act that are set to expire at the end of the year. And on Thursday, the vote came. In fact, two votes on two bills. Senator Chuck Schumer is the Senate Democratic leader.
Today is D-Day, decision day, for Republican senators. Will Republicans side today with the American people and avert the impending health care crisis? Or will they abandon American families as premiums shoot through the roof on January 1st? That is the decision Senate Republicans must make today. I say to my Republican colleagues, our bill is the last train to leave the station.
The Democrats' bill aimed to extend the Obamacare tax credits for 3 years. Republicans presented their own bill, letting the tax credits expire and instead replacing them with health savings accounts. Republican John Thune is the Senate Majority Leader.
Later today, we will vote on the Democrats' partisan messaging bill, which is a clean 3-year extension of the Biden COVID bonuses. And when I say clean, all that I mean by that is no reforms, straight up extension, 3 years of a program without any reforms, any revisions, any changes that would actually help drive down healthcare costs instead of increasing healthcare costs and get rid of the rampant waste, fraud, and abuse in this program.
Republicans have made claims of fraud a centerpiece of their criticisms of the Affordable Care Act, although Democrats strongly disagree and local officials say they don't see high levels of abuse. In any event, both measures went down to defeat. That makes it pretty much inevitable that people on the Affordable Care Act will see their health care costs skyrocket, with other troubles to follow. California Senator Alex Padilla held a news briefing before the vote, saying 20 million Americans could lose their health coverage as health premiums double, triple, or more, and that number includes 400,000 Californians. He blasted the Republican plan.
What seems to be their objective is to push junk health plans on families across the country while allowing these life-saving ACA tax credits to expire. It's an unserious proposal, and it puts lives at risk.
Padilla was joined by health advocates, including Dr. Rachel Ruiz, who works at the Santa Clara Valley Medical Center.
When premiums rise, many patients will be forced to drop their coverage altogether. They won't, however, drop their chronic health conditions, like diabetes or high blood pressure. And now without coverage, they will most definitely delay seeking preventative care. A manageable condition will soon become a costly crisis.
She says losing the Affordable Care Act could push the health system to the breaking point. She says it's not a political issue, it's a matter of preventing a catastrophe.
The ACA tax credits are preventative medicine for our community, and they are a stabilizing force that allows tens of thousands in my county and hundreds of thousands across the state to stay connected to their medical home, to the doctors and medications, and remain healthy.
What happens next remains an open question. Padilla notes that 4 moderate or swing district Republicans voted with Democrats to save the ACA credits. But the challenge, he says, is leadership. He's holding out hope that there could be further action later this year or early next year.
I think I'm one of the eternal optimists in Congress. You have to be optimistic in this job, because if you're not, it can be pretty tough.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Brian Bull reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A Tucson man is facing federal charges for allegedly excavating and trafficking archaeological resources from the Gila River Indian community. The U.S. Attorney's Office says 46-year-old Leo Reynoso stands accused of violating the Archaeological Resources Protection Act. Prosecutors say Reynoso allegedly removed several artifacts from the community without authorization. This included jewelry, Indian trader tokens, crucifixes, and buttons from archaeological sites on tribal land. He also stands accused of selling these items without a permit. The archaeological value of the items is estimated at $29,000, while the cost of repairing the archaeological sites is estimated at $23,000. If convicted, Reynoso faces a $20,000 fine and could get up to 2 years in prison. December 29th will mark the 130th anniversary of the Wounded Knee Massacre. In the second half of a two-part story, KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio shares some Native reactions to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's assertion that the soldiers who took part in the violent and tragic incident deserve their medals of honor.
David Martinez is Akamel Otham, founder and director of ASU's Institute for Transborder Indigenous Nations.
Wherever you see America invading, sending troops, trying to intimidate, all that comes from America's original attitude towards the so-called frontier, which was regarded as wild, which was regarded as dangerous, which was regarded as full of savages.
From the Utes across modern-day Utah and Colorado to the Apaches in Arizona and New Mexico, the Army fought over a dozen conflicts, predating federal recognition of tribal governments.
There is not a tribe anywhere in North America that did not experience deep historic trauma.
Even the Bureau of Indian Affairs emerged in 1824 from within the original War Department. Two centuries later, Martinez suggests it's fitting that Trump has restored the agency's old moniker.
Well, for me, the Department of War is the true name because from my point of view as an indigenous person, the objective in America's conquest of Indian country was to make Indian country like America. It did so at the expense of Indian land and people. And so the reservation system that we see around us today, which includes my people, Akimel Otham, is a product of war.
Lakota attorney Chase Iron Eyes calls the reservations prison camps.
There are those of us who never perceived an end of war. If you look at what the reservation system is, it's not peace, prosperity, and privilege for Native people. It's a little open-air prison camp.
For Iron Eyes, who runs the Lakota People's Law Project, Wounded Knee is deeply personal.
As the great-great-grandson of people who were killed at Wounded Knee, nobody in their right mind takes pride in the slaughtering of non-combatants, women and children.
Marlis Afraid of Hawk grew up hearing horror stories from her grandfather, Richard, who was only 13 when he survived Wounded Knee. The 68-year-old Oglala Lakota elder insists Hegseth is wrong.
He's in denial. Look it up. But he's not going to.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Moore, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Ray Hamill, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Brian Bull. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.